ready everywhere? Okay, call the resources committee to order. We've got Representative Olson, co-chairs Ramirez and Samuels, Elkins and Ledoux. First up today, we're going to talk about HJR 9, urging the United States Congress to honor the process and judgment of the federal courts in the case of the Exxon Valdez disaster and to refrain from enacting legislation that would affect the outcome of the court's resolution of the case by Representative Ledoux.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I'm Suzanne Hancock. I'm staff to Representative Gabrielle Ledoux. Thank you very much for hearing this House joint resolution today. This resolution would be from the Alaska State Legislature to urge the United States Congress to respect the judicial process and refrain from enacting any legislation that would alter the punitive damages award to more than 32,000 plaintiffs as a result of the 1989 Exxon Valdez oil spill, as finally determined by the federal courts. After nearly 16 years and more than 10 years after the original jury verdict, the plaintiffs are still waiting resolution of the lawsuit. While the United States Congress considered the Oil Pollution Act of 1990, ExxonMobil Corporation sought an amendment that would have substantially reduced the punitive damages that would have been paid from the Exxon Valdez oil spill. This resolution urges Congress only to let the courts determine the matter. I believe there is at least one person online to testify and perhaps some other.
Any questions for Suzanne? No? And we'll go online here for testimony. Is Matt Jamin? Are you with us, Matt?
Yes, sir, I am, from Kodiak.
Okay. If you could state your name for the record and continue with your testimony.
All right, sir. My name is Matt Jamin. I live in Kodiak, Alaska. I am one of the attorneys that represent the plaintiffs in the Exxon Valdez oil spill litigation. The plaintiffs and their counsel support this resolution. The principal reason is that this is a time in federal Congress when bills appear to be passed very quickly without a great deal of public input on various issues. We think it is certainly possible because Congress is, and appropriately so, concerned about class action litigation in the United States, tort litigation, and specifically tort reform in the United States. It is certainly possible that without any intent, Congress might pass a law that would retroactively alter the situation in our case. It is our view that it is the best thing now for the courts to continue to resolve this case, hopefully quickly, without any interference by Congress, intentional or otherwise, that would affect a jury verdict that is already close to 10 and a half years old. So we very much support the resolution, and I would be eager to answer any questions that any members of the committee might have. Thank you very much.
Okay. Thank you, Matt. Are there any questions for Matt? No? Is there anybody else online that wanted to testify on HJR 9? Anybody else in the audience?
There are a number of people in Cordova. I haven't got the list yet, and they might be available there.
Is Cordova online?
Okay, this might just take a second. There was a disconnection on the internet. They should be there, but I'm going to have to reconnect the meeting time.
We're online.
Okay.
Do you have any names?
We're still trying to send our participant names. Mike Maxwell is the first person we have to speak.
And we would welcome Mr. Maxwell to begin his testimony.
Yes, I was born in Cordova in 1960, began my commercial fishing career at 9 years old, fished both salmon and herring. I began working in a local net shop after graduating from high school. I would spend my winters building and repairing salmon and herring nets, spring and summer fishing. Needless to say, I know the fisheries ins and outs. I know the people that work and fish in Prince William Sound area. Our lives were drastically changed when the Exxon Valdez ran aground in 89. Within a few years, our herring fisheries were totally wiped out. We lost a huge portion of our livelihood because of this, or because of the oil spill. Our price, salmon prices and permit prices went at about the same time. Fishermen that had $500,000 boats sold them for pennies on the dollar. Right now in Cordova, we have $30,000 nets stacked up like cardboard and haven't been used for 15 years. Along with the fisheries, my wintertime job slowly lost business year by year. The winter job that was so important for me and my family just went away with the loss of our herring. Now I work 30 days out of the winter where I used to work for 5 months. I lost my much-needed health insurance. At 45 years old, the strenuous work since I was 9 years old, I have many medical problems. My first hip replacement was 3 years ago. I still had my health insurance then. Now my hip has gone out on me again with last year's fishing season and with the loss of my health insurance. And if it wasn't for my friends, family, and community having a benefit for me last year, I would not have been able to have it fixed. My other hip is almost in the same condition, and I don't have a clue how I will fix that. My boat is in the same shape and needs a lot of work to be able to compete in one of the last fisheries we have in the state, in this area, which is the Copper River. Exxon has taken many fisheries and livelihoods away from many of us for the last 16 years. I will be filing for bankruptcy protection this next month. I'm just one of many that have had to do this. Where's the help from our politicians and our government? Our court system has failed us. I would be totally shocked to see our state government stand up and make a real statement to Exxon. How about not letting Exxon in on the bids for drilling in on ANWR? How about laws quadrupling verdicts to large corporations for using their great influence to stifle court proceedings? Where's the help? You people have done nothing for us for too long. While Exxon makes millions, we go broke. Our politicians are the only people who can help us now to see that justice is done. How come we all feel we've been let down? You people and all in Exxon's pocket, it just seemed to us. I don't know if you were truly on our side, there would be enough legislation to see that justice is served. My daughter, who was 2 years old at the time of the spill, graduates from high school this spring. My biggest dream was to send her to a good school, and hopefully one of these days I'll be able to do it. Please help us. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Maxwell. Are there any questions? Next up, we've got Roxy Estes from Cordova. Are you there, Roxy?
Yes, I'm here.
Yeah.
I'm Roxy Estes, born in 1945 in Cordova, Alaska. I was raised here. My folks were both fishermen. Exxon literally destroyed my life and drove my children elsewhere to make a living. So I have been just bereft of having my children around me and my grandchildren. Placing a cap on damages regarding the Exxon is ludicrous. The damage done is beyond words. There is no way you can replace something that is literally priceless. They didn't just destroy our way of making a living, they destroyed our lives. Obviously, big oil has so far had their way entirely. Money talks. They literally bulldozed right over us with no one in the political arena willing to stand up for us. There are people who have died, those whose families have been destroyed, those other people have gone bankrupt, and nobody has been held accountable. Exxon's excellent PR campaign has been enormously successful. Everyone worldwide thinks Prince William Sound is fine. It is not. It probably never will be again. My husband is in failing health. We hang on by a hair's breadth. Our state and federal government need to do the job they were elected to do and represent the people who put them in office, not Exxon. It would really behoove everybody to stand up for the little guy. We're supposedly the backbone of this country. Right now, it doesn't look like that is the picture at all. Thank you.
Thank you. Are there any questions for Roxy? Okay. Dolly Scott from Cordova?
She's coming up.
Okay.
My name is Dolly Scott, and I was born and raised in the Cordova, Prince William Sound area. 25 years ago I was born, so it makes me rather ancient. But I've seen the everything since the oil spill go downhill, the herring, the crab, everything that we used to fish, and that's the way we make our living. And unless this is settled, and settled soon, I don't know what we're going to do. And if it isn't settled, that'll just give them a wide open invitation to do it again. All the fishermen fought against having that pipeline come out of Valdez, and they did it anyway. And if it had been a storm, I think we could have lived with that, but it was a drunken accident. And that's all I've got to say.
Okay. Any questions for Dolly? We have Michael Scott.
Since 1978 and fished here since then. And like everyone else here, I've taken and we felt this impact, and people from throughout the United States seem to think that this Exxon has paid off everything, and nothing's been paid to the fishermen. And so I think it's time that we send a statement somehow to take and big corporations pay up before they can do business within the state. Thank you.
Okay, thank you very much. Are there any questions for Michael Scott? No? Diane Platt?
For the record, my name is Diane Platt, and I'm here today representing Cordova District Fishermen United, an organization which represents nearly 900 commercial fishermen in Area E. Many of these individuals have been devastated by the Exxon Valdez disaster of 1989. And I encourage any attempt to bring this process to a closure and get the plaintiffs the settlements they have been waiting for so long. I support House Joint Resolution number 9, and I thank you for your time.
Yeah, are there any questions for Diane? Steve Smith? You on here, Steve?
Yep, you bet. My name is Steve Smith. I've been a commercial fisherman here for 40-some years. Half of my income used to be from the herring fishery. We haven't had a herring fishery for many, many years, and there's nothing on the immediate horizon that indicates it's about to start up again either. This case has been kicking around in the courts back and forth a lot longer than I think is reasonable. It appears that Exxon has a lot of money. They don't mind spending it on their attorneys, and they're very reluctant to go ahead and pay the bill that the courts have and the juries have deemed we have coming. So I thank you, gentlemen, for this bill, and encourage you to do whatever you can to see if we can get this thing taken care of, because justice delayed is not really justice. So thank you.
Okay. Thank you very much, Steve. Is there anybody else online that wanted to testify on HJR number 9? Is there anybody else in the audience? Gary?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Jerry McCune. I represent United Fishermen of Alaska. I just got off the phone with our attorneys, and what this bill does is there's been several attempts by Exxon to write legislation to write themselves out of the punitive damages, and they're on constant watch down there in Washington, D.C. Our attorneys are for any right or anything that might be put into some other legislation that would cause this to go away and not be in the court. So the purpose of the resolution, even though, as you hear, people get very emotional about this issue, and I don't blame them, we've lived through it for a long time, but what this resolution would do is urge Congress not to pass anything that would come up that would legislate them out of the the court decision or any other decision that might come down the line out of the punitive damages, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. Any questions for Jerry? Anybody else in the audience that wants to testify that hasn't? Bob?
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Okay. With that, we'll close public testimony, and it's the will of the committee. We've also been joined by Representative Crawford for the record also.
Mr. Chairman, I would move that we move House Joint Resolution 9 from committee.
Okay.
With individual recommendations.
And the attached zero fiscal notes?
I think there is attached zero fiscal note, yes.
Is there any objection to that? Hearing none, HJR 9 passes from committee. Next up, we've got HJR 16.
Nice.
Co-chairman.
Thank you. Representative Vilkins, who do you?
I have Jim Van Horn from my staff here to introduce this and our talks about
it. Hi, Jim. Go ahead. Begin, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Jim Van Horn. I'm on the staff of Representative Jim Elkins. Before us this afternoon is House Joint Resolution number 16. It opposes the designation of any area in Alaska as a World Heritage Site, Biosphere Reserve, or any other type of international designation without the specific consent of the Alaska State Legislature. It also urges the United States Congress to pass and the President to sign legislation and require approval by an act of Congress before any area in the United States or its territories can be nominated as a World Heritage Site, Biosphere Reserve, or any other type of international designation. The resolution urges the Congress of the United States to reaffirm the power of Congress under Article 4, Section 3 of the United States Constitution over international agreements which concern disposal, management, and use of lands belonging to the United States, to protect state powers not reserved by the federal government under the Constitution from federal actions designating lands pursuant to international agreements, ensure that no United States citizen suffers any dismissal of law or loss of individual rights as a result of federal actions designating lands pursuant to international agreements or for purposes of imposing restrictions on land use or use of those lands, protect private interest in real property from dismissal as a result of federal actions designating lands pursuant to international agreements. Also, Mr. Chairman, there is a letter from the Resource Development Council that was just received. It was laid on the table. Part of your packet. I am open for any questions. Thank you.
Thank you. Are there any questions from the committee? Great. Appreciate your testimony. We've got some people. I'm sorry. Representative Crawford.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm going to display my ignorance again, as I do fairly often.
Feel free, Representative Crawford.
When they call it OO. World Heritage Site or Biosphere Reserve. And I've never heard the Biosphere Reserve designation before. Could you explain that a little bit for me?
Yes, I can. Through the chair to you, Representative Crawford. Biosphere Reserve is an area of terrestrial and coastal ecosystems promoting solutions to reconcile the conservation of biodiversity with its sustainable use. That's right from the website of the United Nations Educational, Scientific, and Cultural Organization called UNESCO, which governs these biosphere reserves. There's nothing within that we can find that the United States Congress or the United States has entered into any international agreement concerning biosphere reserves. They sort of showed up. Biosphere Reserve has three. Once it's designated, it has three different areas. They call the core area, the buffer zone, and the transitional zone. In the core area of a biosphere reserve, if I might revert back here, the core area. Normally, the core area is not subject to human activity. Then you have the buffer zone. Buffer zones. They do not organize here. They do not enter the conservation objectives of the core area, but really help to protect it. Hence the term buffer zone. Some of these buffer zones have been proposed as far out as 55 miles from the core area. So they're hindering any development or use of the land not directly involved in the core area. And the transitional zone is the area outside of that where they, again, develop the area's resources for the benefit of the people who live there. And majority of the biosphere reserves, they're talking about people in South America and so forth, where they sell their wares, baskets, and native arts and stuff of this nature. But what is disturbing about the World Heritage Site or a biosphere reserve, the World Heritage Site, the Secretary of the Interior, by just a signature of her pen, can designate a World Heritage Site, does not go before Congress. Same with the biosphere reserve. The Secretary of State, by her signature, his or her signature, can designate a biosphere reserve. Again, it does not go before the Congress, so it's circumventing the Constitution. That's our understanding of it. I hope I've answered your questions.
Well, I know a lot more now than I did to start with.
Thank you, sir.
Thank you very much. I didn't know anything about biospheres either. We've been joined by our friends Representative Gatto and Representative Kapsner. Any other questions? None. Your excuse. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Our pleasure. We're going to go online to Cindy Mittelstadt. Cindy with us? Okay. Hi, Cindy. Are you with us?
I am. Yes, I am.
Could you state who you're with for the record, please?
Sure. The Alaska Support Industry Alliance, better known as the Alliance.
Go ahead.
Just to reiterate, I am Cindy Middleton. I'm the communications manager for the Alliance. The Alliance is a nonprofit trade group comprised of approximately 400 members who derive their livelihood from the oil, gas, and mining industries. Our membership represents over 25,000 employees statewide. I'd like to thank the chairs and the committee members here today for this opportunity to testify regarding HJR 16. The Alliance supports this resolution as our contractors know firsthand the impacts of environmental interference, including legal maneuvers that delay and or completely halt a development project. The designation of World Heritage Sites or use of other conservation designations would provide yet another tool for the international environmentalist groups and wildlife activists to stall responsible, viable projects in our state. The Alliance can't emphasize to any greater degree the certainty industry projects need to get off the ground and maintain operations once online. With the prospect of international movements or ill-spirited motivations, the fear factor for doing business in Alaska could increase significantly, and Alaska's economic health would certainly weaken. It is only appropriate that our U.S. congressional delegation consider federal legislation before any nomination of U.S. lands as Biosphere Reserve, World Heritage Site, or any of the other named conservation designations. The Alliance supports House Joint Resolution 16 opposing the designation of any Alaska lands for this purpose. Thank you for the time and the teleconference link to participate today.
Thank you, Cindy. Does anybody have any questions for Ms. Mittelstadt? We thank you for your testimony.
Thank you.
Our pleasure. Next is Jason Brune. Can you state your name and who you're with, please, Jason?
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, thank you for the opportunity to testify. For the record, my name is Jason Bruni. I'm the projects coordinator for the Resource Development Council. And on behalf of the Resource Development Council, I would like to express our support for HJR 16. RDC is a private, nonprofit trade association representing individuals and companies from each of Alaska's basic industries: oil and gas, mining, timber, tourism, and fisheries. Our membership also includes native regional and village corporations, local communities, and organized labor. RDC's mission is to help grow Alaska's economy through the responsible development of the state's natural resources. Before I continue, I'd like to echo all of Cindy Mittelstadt's comments with the Alliance. Also, I'd like to add that, as you all probably know, ANILCA created a vast network of conservation system units in Alaska. The federal government currently lays claim to over 235 million acres in Alaska, which is 64% of the state's total land mass. Over 58 million acres of this land is officially designated wilderness, giving Alaska 55% of the nation's total wilderness lands. put this number in perspective, Alaska's federally designated wilderness lands are greater in size than each of the following states: Florida, Illinois, Minnesota, New York, and Washington. In addition, the state of Alaska has created the largest state park system in the Union. Because of this level of protection, the creation of additional World Heritage sites, marine biospheres, or international parks in Alaska is unnecessary. Such designations would severely limit the economic potential of resource development projects throughout our great state. Further, because of the No More Clause of ANILCA, additional lands in Alaska are prohibited from being added as conservation system units. RDC believes Alaskans and Alaskans alone are best positioned to make decisions regarding our land and our resources. Therefore, we endorse the intent of this resolution to mandate the consent of the Alaska State Legislature and the U.S. Congress prior to the establishment of future World Heritage Sites, biosphere reserves, or any other type of international designations. Thank you again for the opportunity to comment.
Thank you very much, Mr. Bruni. Are there any questions for Mr. Bruni? Sir, thank you very much for your testimony. We appreciate it. Next, we'd like to hear from Steve Burrell with the Miners Association.
Yes, Mr. Chairman. Thank you, committee members. My name is Steve Burrell. I'm the executive director of the Alaska Miners Association, and I'm testifying on behalf of the association. Thank you for the opportunity to comment on Joint Resolution 16, which deals with designation of lands as international conservation system units. We believe that in addition to being prohibited by ANILCA, such designations would pose a serious threat to future economic development in Alaska. If additional World Heritage Sites and or biosphere reserves were established, they would be used to harass development projects in Alaska, just as has been done elsewhere in the world. Regarding ANILCA, the no more intent found in ANILCA makes it clear that no more lands in Alaska should be added to any type of conservation system unit. ANILCA specifically states that administrative actions such as the Antiquities Act cannot be used to close more lands, and that federal agencies are not even allowed to study areas for designation as a conservation system unit unless the study is specifically authorized by an act of Congress. In various countries around the world, World Heritage Sites and Biosphere Reserves have been used by environmental groups to stop development projects in various ways. One project in Australia, was harassed by environmental groups picketing the board meeting of a company in Germany that had contracted to buy production from the mine. At an underground mine that was proposed on the Kamchatka Peninsula in the Russian Far East, three environmental groups petitioned the U.S. Overseas Private Investment Corporation, known as OPIC, O-P-I-C, to not provide business risk insurance for the company that was trying to develop the mine because it was, quote, near a World Heritage Site. Not in the site, but near a site. Without this insurance, the cost of capital would be too high, and indeed, the company did not build the mine, which would have greatly improved the lives of many people in that economically depressed part of Russia. Incidentally, the Kamchatka World Heritage Site designation was placed as an overlay on top of parks and preserves that had already been established by the Russian government. International designations would create an additional rallying point for environmental groups all around the world to harass Alaska projects. If a World Heritage Site or Biosphere Reserve had been in place in Western Alaska at the time the Red Dog Mine was being considered, I am confident that such designations would have been used to harass Red Dog and likely would have blocked its development. The final resolved paragraph of HJR 16 urges the U.S. Congress to pass legislation requiring an act of Congress before any land in the United States can be nominated as a World Heritage Site, Biosphere Reserve, or any other type of international designation. This is extremely important. We are not concerned that such designations would be forced upon Alaska during the current administration, but this requirement is definitely needed for the future. Thank you for the opportunity to comment. We encourage you to move the bill, and if you'd like, I could get a copy of my testimony written form into a letter for the sponsor. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Burrell. Yes, that would be helpful. We'd appreciate that as part of the packet. Are there any questions for Mr. Burrell? Thank you very much, sir. Next, we'd like to go to Irene Anderson with the Bering Straits Native Corporation.
Hello, this is Irene Anderson. I'm in Nome. I'm the assistant land manager at Bering Straits Native Corporation in Western Alaska, and I certainly thank you and your staff's work on this important resolution. I recommend its passage. I live in the area and have worked time for the last, 15, 16 years in opposition of the Marine Biosphere or the International Park in what the National Park Service calls Beringia. One thing on your last further resolve on page 3, your wording talks about the Alaska legislature urges Congress to pass and President to sign. That would sign legislation that will require approval of an act before any area in the United States or its territories can be nominated as a World Heritage Site, Biosphere Reserve, or any other international designation. Right now, the federal budget in Department of Interior and through the National Park Service allocates a lot of money to study Beringia International Park and to do projects. A lot of the studies are certainly not done in Alaska. They're done in Lower 48 at universities or even in other countries. I don't know if you would consider adding something in that last further resolve that would stop authorization of federal money for studies of these areas, specific, you know, I don't know. I know there's a lot of money being spent on Beringia studies. They have a big deal about it down in Anchorage once a year with bringing all their study reports in. And a lot of the information that are gathered within the studies are nice, but they don't need to be calling them international park issues. The meeting that was held a few summers ago with the Eastern Russian Native people, they did not desire international park status in their neighborhood. They are looking to do a study on how they could obtain land ownership. They're studying all the native land claims throughout the world on how they've been handled in Australia and Canada, Greenland, and certainly Alaska, and the just everything dealing with that type of land ownership. Bering Straits itself, we have land within and adjacent to the Bering Land Bridge National Preserve. One of our member village corporations, Shishmaref, has land adjacent and contiguous to this preserve and is in need of looking to move to get away from some of their erosion problems. And there are issues that we deal with all the time on just the national preserve. And if we get these World Heritages or international parks or the marine biosphere, we could see that not only would the native land be affected in any of our development or resource development issues, but neighboring state land. There's a lot of state land in Western Alaska. There's a number of patented mining claims. There's active state mining claim holders who do mine right south of the preserve, and we would expect that that would no longer happen because of these traditional zones and the buffer zones that come way south of with the preserve. I would be kind of concerned if I was in that Katmai area, because one of the square assets was talking about something going on in the Katmai area on page 2, like, the whereas page line 20 to 25, talked about Katmai National Park and that type of stuff. Those things are could certainly affect any type of development in the Pebble Project area, or perhaps even the Donlin Creek.
Irene?
Those are, yes?
Representative Kapsner has passed us a note that your folks represented the Nome District before Richard Foster that we serve with here. Is that correct?
Yeah.
Excellent. Well, we're very honored to have you testifying before us. Do you have any?
Yeah.
Go ahead.
Yeah. And Mary, I hope you have an enjoyable evening with the Women's Policy reception tonight. I wish I could be there. Couldn't make it down for this evening's event. Thank you very much, and I support this House Joint Resolution 16.
Thank you. Thank you very much, Irene. Representative Kapsner?
No, Irene, I was just going to say you're really good because I actually bailed out of that, but now I may have to go.
Okay. I'll get a report.
Any questions for Ms. Anderson? All right, and we will, if you want to stay online, we'll check with the sponsor and see if he wants to adopt any of those changes after we wind up a testimony. Thank you very much, Irene.
You're welcome.
Yes, ma'am. We also have Dick Coos in Ketchikan. Dick, are you with us?
I'm here. Can you hear me?
Yes, we can. Please state your name and go for it.
Hey, thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Dick Coos here in Ketchikan. I represent Concerned Alaskans for Resource and Environment, or CARE, and myself, and CARE is a nonprofit group that was formed by the local citizens and businesses of Ketchikan to keep access to our resources. I encourage the committee to approve HJR 16 that asks basically for the U.S. legislature to require that the Congress and the state legislature approve any UN designations of World Heritage Sites, Biosphere Reserves, or any other type of international designation. I think HGR 16 pretty well spells out the problems with the UN placing designations without any elected body approval. These UN designations ultimately restrict or stop public use or economic development on private and public lands. And a good example of this is the Yellowstone Park designation a number of years ago, and Steve Burrell can probably expound more on this, but there was a development of a mine outside of the park boundary on private land, and it was ultimately stopped, I think sold, and just went away. And it was a direct result of this UN designation. I would also encourage you to amend the resolution to add local government approval to the resolve on top of page 3. And I'm a past borough assembly person, and I think the local governments should have say-so in what happens within the lands within their jurisdiction. So basically, just please pass HGR 16. The UN is a non-elected body and should have no authority to impose land use restrictions on federal, state, or private lands, and we don't need their interference in our lives. So thank you, and move forward.
Thank you very much, Mr. Coos. Are there any questions for Mr. Coos? Representative Elkins?
Dick, do you have this, Jim, do you have any specific language for that amendment?
Jim, I think at either one of those resolves on top of page 3, you could just add, I'll say, and local governments.
Okay.
Line 3, top of page 3, would probably somewhere right in there. The law should allow the local governments as well as the state governments to participate in these decisions.
Thank you.
Thank you very much for your constructive comments, Mr. Coos. Anybody else offline? All right. Is there anybody who wants to testify here in this room? Fine. We're going to close public testimony, move to committee discussion. Representative Elkins, do you want to move any amendments to?
Well, I'd like to hold this over so we can draft some amendments and present them at another date.
Okay.
And if the woman from Mary from your district could maybe
Richard
give
Foster's.
Us some yeah. language would help.
Any other committee discussion about this, or should we just hold it over until you bring something fresher back to us?
I want to see this move, but I think let's move it right.
Okay, you got it. All right, we'll hold this over. Move to GUI ducts, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. Next up, we've got HB 198, an act relating to aquatic farming and providing for an effective date by Representative Elkins. And?
Just remind
We're going to try to get out of here. We've got a joint meeting with Senate Resources in the Senate Finance Room at 2:20.
Move it fast.
I'll read the short version.
Sure.
Members of the committee, Josh Govar, staff to Representative Elkins. Thank you for taking up House Bill 198 today. It amends state's Aquatic Farming Act to allow aquatic farms to continue to operate in compliance with a recent Supreme Court decision. In order to be implemented, a change in statute is required, and HB 198 will amend the Aquatic Farming Act to allow shellfish farmers to own, harvest, and sell insignificant populations of wild shellfish stocks on their aquatic farm sites. Recently, the Department of Fish and Game opened a commercial dive fishery on designated mariculture sites to remove the commercially significant population of wild gooey ducks from these small areas. This fishery has been open to all commercial divers in Southeast Alaska and is preparing these sites for future mariculture. This legislation, the product of industry members and the administration working to find a compromise, will help ensure the future of this new fishery in southern and southeast Alaska for years to come. Thank you very much.
I don't know who I want to pose a question to, but I do have one, Mr. Chairman. I was wondering about the taxation on this.
Through the chair, Representative Kapsner, there are a number of members from Fish and Game, SARDFA, as well as the Alaska Shellfish Growers Association, and the Department of Law, all standing by to testify. And any one of those people will be better than myself to answer
I'll
those
wait.
Questions.
Okay. Don't go anywhere. Okay. First up, we've got Julie Decker. Sorry. Julie, are you on? Yes, we can now.
Okay. Thank you for this opportunity to testify. My name is Julie Decker, and I'm the Executive Director of the Southeast Alaska Regional Dive Fisheries Association, or SARDFA. SARDFA supports HB 198. It's basically a result of the Supreme Court decision last spring, and which sort of forced all the parties to come to the table and come to an acceptable compromise. And since last spring, the Shellfish Growers Association, SARDFA, the Department of Fish and Game, the Department of Law have worked together to come to this agreement, which has been implemented in this bill, basically. On the issue of the levy, or I think Representative Kapsner referred to it as the tax, SARDFA believes that that should be set in regulations, as this is a somewhat new way to approach resource management. And if the legislature believes it's appropriate to set the levy in statute, SARDFA encourages you to do that as high as possible. And the reason being that the court's decision basically said that you cannot hand significant stocks over to an individual. And in these handful of cases in the law that we're talking about on farmers to harvest significant stocks, the reason is to clean up a mess that basically we're all left with. But in order to comply with the court's decision, we believe the levy would need to be set as high as possible so that there's no net profit going to the farmer. Basically, they're being allowed to clear their land to prepare it for their farming activity. So I also submitted a letter. The committee should have that, and I think that's all my testimony for today. Thank you.
Okay, are there any questions for Julie? Also, just for anybody that might be online or in the audience, we will not get to HB 174 today at all. Next up for 198, we've got Robert Hartley from Homer. Are you on here with us, Robert?
Yes, I am. I'm Robert Hartley. I'm an oyster farmer here in Kachemak Bay and president of the Alaska Shellfish Growers Association. And I'd like to thank you all for hearing this bill. House Bill 198 is an enabling bill that will allow the shellfish industry to move forward in compliance with the Supreme Court ruling that we had last spring. ASGA is in favor of this agreement, and along with the Department of Fish and Game and the Dive Fishermen. I would like to thank David Bedford of the Department of Fish and Game and Julie Decker of the Dive Fishery and Roger Painter from ASGA for reaching a compromise that enables this bill to go forward. Without this bill, our gooey duck farms will probably be dead in the water. And we need this bill to keep them going. And without the gooey duck farms, our hatchery and Seward will probably most likely go away, because the gooey duck seed is a vital part of the hatcheries, the shellfish hatcheries business plan. Again, we're in favor of the bill, and thank you very much for hearing this bill.
Hey, are there any questions for Mr. Hartley? Okay, next up, speaking of the devil here, we've got David Bedford with ADF&G.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is David Bedford. I'm Deputy Commissioner of the Alaska Department of Fish and Game and one of the three principal folks involved in trying to develop this compromise that you have in front of you. We view this as being in some regards remedial legislation. For some time, we've had an environment in this state that was not particularly conducive to the development of what we think will, in the end result, be a very productive industry, in particular shellfish mariculture. Beyond that, we also have had the problem that we've had a very uneven reception from the courts on this. And we have, as the other folks who have been testifying have pointed out, a couple of decisions that really illustrate the kinds of problems that we've had with this. We had, first off, a Superior Court decision that said the Constitution of the state bars the Department of Fish and Game from transferring to shellfish farmers a significant amount of common property resource. However, it also compels us to transfer to farmers an insignificant amount because of the provision, the inclusion of aquaculture in the exception to the no exclusive right of fishery clause. So places that requirement upon us. Having been told by the Superior Court that we must do this, we then have the Supreme Court say to us, you can't. You don't have any statutory authority to do that. So the legislation that you have in front of you, at Section 1, remedies the kind of problem that we ran into with raised by the Supreme Court and provides the opportunity for us to allow shellfish farmers to harvest insignificant amounts of stock that is resident on their farm site. We've been in quite a lengthy process trying to work with the affected stakeholders to try to develop a regulatory environment that would be more conducive to the development of this industry. This has included working with the divers and with the shellfish farmers. And we have been working on what kinds of regulations we would be thinking would be appropriate for defining a significant or an insignificant stock of resident stocks of shellfish. And for gooey ducks at this point, the staff is working on 12,000 pounds per farm site as being a number that's very likely a reasonable one. Now, when we go into a full public regulatory review, that'll be one of the options that we're looking at that time. Parsing through the legislation, there are some other elements in this that we view as being very important. Moving along to Section 2, this then places clearly reiterates the Superior Court's direction that we may not authorize a taking of significant stocks of shellfish by a farmer, and therefore says that if we're going to permit a shellfish farm, that the only stock that can be on there is indeed an insignificant stock. This will require us then to go out and do competent surveys to assure that that is that quantum of the resource is indeed what is present, that or less. Section 3 creates a new authority for the commissioner, and one that is, from our perspective, rather important. In a fairly uneven environment that we had for shellfish mariculture in the past, without a clear picture of what it is, what quantum of public resource could be on a shellfish site, we have authorized some sites that have too much on them. So as one of the previous testifiers said, we are currently conducting a commercial fishery to remove the significant quantity. However, we have a few sites where there's been substantial activity by the farmers on those sites. Were we to authorize a commercial fishery on those sites, it would really interrupt their enterprise. So we're seeking authority in some limited instances to be able to allow a farmer to harvest what would be a significant amount of resource. Now, accompanying that, we would levy against the farmer a price for taking a public resource. I mean, we would not refer to it as a taxation, because taxation is something that is levied against something that you own. And in this instance, a significant amount of shellfish is something that we can't convey to a farmer, so it can't be something they own. So what we are conveying to them then is the right to harvest, and they would then be compensating the public for harvesting the public resource. So in that sense, we'd be looking at what kind of a levy would be appropriate. We're treading a little bit of kind of new ground here, and the advice that we've received on this is that the greater the compensation that the public receives, then the more supportable it is to allow that kind of exclusive harvest by a farmer. So at this point, the kinds of figures that we're looking at, and again, we'll go through a thorough regulatory process on this, the kind of thing that we're thinking about now would be about 50% on a harvest in which there was a live sale, and about 30% on a harvest in which there was a processed sale. Those two product forms have very different values to them. And of course, one of the considerations that has to go into this is that whatever sort of price was charged to farmers would have to be somewhere below the break-even point. So that would be one of the factors that we'd be taking into account in looking at this. Section 5 is an important one from our perspective as well. The way that things stand at present, as a matter of course, with a commercial fishery, we don't allow access to sort of proprietary records. You can't find out how much fish a fisherman caught or how much fish a processor purchased. Similarly, we think that shellfish farmers should have a same kind of shelter from having their records, the kinds of sales and production that they have, be an open book to the public. We do, however, think that it's important that on a cumulative basis that we report to the public the total amount of common property resource that was taken off of any one particular farm site. So again, another section that we think is important. And I know that I skipped one in here, because there's another one in here that really is designed to prevent a manifest injustice. The law as it currently stands requires an aquaculture permit holder to, at the end of their tenure, return any resident stock to the level that was there at the time that they got their permit. Given that we're now conducting a commercial fishery on several aquaculture sites, those people, as the law is now written, would be obligated to replace the shellfish that were removed by the commercial fishery. So we have a section in here that would modify that to say that a farmer would be obligated to, in essence, replace what he had taken off the site, but not what somebody else had taken. In any event, that concludes my remarks. I'd be glad to respond to any questions you might have.
Just while you're here, I'd like to, for the members to consider. I don't know if an amendment, there had been talk of an amendment being offered to put the number on insignificant population. I won't be offering the amendment, but in case it comes up on the floor, you kind of respond now, put in a 12,000 pound or 10,000. Talk was on. I don't know if the amendment will be offered or not.
Well,
if it's not and it is offered later in the process, could you explain the insignificant population? And why would you rather do that in regulation than statute?
Well, we'd prefer to do it in regulation, because we think that regulation, the process, allows us to go through a thorough process of not only gathering public comment on that, but also developing the scientific and management rationale for why it is one particular number is superior to another. We think that kind of process is the sort of thing that's far more likely to withstand legal challenge.
Okay. Are there any other questions
for David? Just to follow up on that, Mr. Bedford, would it also be easier to change the regulation, change the amount of insignificant versus significant if it's in regulation as opposed to statute?
Through the chair, yes, it would. However, I would say this, that to the extent that we develop a fully articulated record that shows that 12,000 pounds or whatever is the appropriate amount, then were we to change that, then we would go through a regulatory process in which we would have to disprove what we previously proved.
Okay. I have another question.
Yes.
So if I understand this correctly, the reason that the taxes the levy is set at 50% for livestock and 30% for non-livestock is to appease the court or to prevent future litigation?
Through the chair, that's one part of it. I mean, really, what we're looking at, the principal criterion is not to prevent litigation, although it is in sort of an indirect fashion. I mean, the principal question is, what is adequate compensation to the public for a common property resource? Now, that would, of course, be at the same time the question that the court would likely look at. But nonetheless, independent of whether any court is looking at it, that's what we feel we would be obligated to do.
Mr. Chairman, if we could just back up a step. I'm not at all familiar with aquatic farming, and the concept is pretty alien to me coming from a livestock fishery. And I can understand how livestock would be viewed, you know, live salmon stock would be viewed as common property. But when you apply that to farming, I don't understand the rationale, because if somebody has a farm, like in Nebraska, that's not common stock. So how does aquatic farming work in terms of common property and non-common property?
Yeah, through the chair. In aquatic farming, what we're talking about when we talk about the common property resource is that resident stock that is on a farm site when a lease is granted.
So it's natural species in their natural environment.
That's correct. And a farmer would come into a particular tenure and they would plant their own stock on it, which would not be a common property stock. That would be their personal property.
I guess I'm just not following, Mr. Chairman, if I could follow up.
Certainly.
So how is this lucrative if the farmer then has to repay if the state assesses a 50% levy on live stock that perhaps they planted?
Through the chair, there would be no levy on any stock that a farmer had planted.
Okay.
There would be levy only on common property stock, which was removed from a farm site, and even there, only on that stock, which exceeded an insignificant amount.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you. Any other questions? Representative Crawford.
Just one more dumb one.
Yeah.
No dumb questions.
How do you know the difference between one that's been planted and one that's, they're natural? Are they easily identifiable?
Through the chair. Yes, Representative Crawford, they are. For example, the most recent evaluation that we did of some geoduck coming off of one particular farm site indicated that their average age was about 50 years. We would expect that there would be no cultured geoducks that would be harvested off a farm that would be any older than perhaps 7 or 8 years old. So the distinction between them is fairly clear.
So a 50-year-old geoduck is much, much larger than a 7-year-old? Is that what you just said, 7 years?
Through the chair. It's older, and it's looking a little bit worse for the wear. It's, shall we say, a little older looking.
Can you explain what a geoduck is and its life cycle and what it looks like and what it eats, where its habitat is?
Through the chair, no, but I think I've got somebody here who can.
And this is mostly out of curiosity, and I don't want to hold up the committee, but I just have no idea. We don't have geoducks on the Kuskokwim.
Maybe you do.
No.
Yeah, I doubt it.
It's like a large razorback, really.
Okay, huge.
And a long neck.
Okay.
We got one other person to testify.
Okay.
Paul Foos.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. Paul Foos, representing PAC Alaska, one of the farming operations, and thank you for considering this legislation, and hopefully this will settle at least one portion of a very long and bitter battle that has been going on for at least the last 6 years in trying to get farming started in Alaska. And this is going to be a good industry for Alaska. Just as a matter of scale, one 5-acre farm can produce as many geoducks as the entire commercial harvest fishery in 1 year. 1 5-acre farm. And it's going to help the wild fisheries if we can supply the product year-round rather than try to come in just at one period of time, the short harvest period, to come into the market. So we want to work with the farmers. The tension comes in the biology that you have all have asked questions about. You want to go to a site that has some that's good habitat. There's none on it. There's a reason. That's poor habitat for them. They're broadcast spawners. They spawn out into the ocean, and they settle where they can make a living. So if you restricted only sites with zero on them, then, you know, it'd be guaranteed to fail. And so we looked for sites and said, okay, so what is significant? And this was the court case. The Superior Court said you can't give them a site with more than significant and gave instructions to the department to identify significance. Well, that never happened. The department never identified what was a significant stock. So we battled around about that for a while, and finally, they for their own, for the commercial fishery, if it's 100,000 pounds or less, they'd never allow a commercial fishery on it, because at a 2% exploitation rate, that's only 2,000 pounds. That's 2 days of diving for one boat. That's not a commercial fishery. So then SARDFA came in and said, well, let's make it 50,000 pounds. Well, then the department came and said, no, in their latest draft regulation, let's make it 25,000. Pounds. Well, now we're down to 12,000 pounds, and we're doing a commercial fishery on the site. So hopefully, we're finally to the point where we could say this is insignificant. By the way, the reason these sites are out there is because the legislature was so fed up with the department not granting sites for farms that they passed House Bill 208, which mandated the department to put these farm sites out there. Every site we're talking about now was found by the department to hold insignificant stocks on it. Otherwise, they would never have granted the site. In the meantime, battling through all this, finally, someone in the governor's office said, well, at least gave them the sites that you say have zero on them, which we did, and there turned out there were some on there. So they were harvesting those. In the meantime, they came in and seized that, which was operating under their permit, and threatened to file charges against the people who are harvesting them. These are my clients. And so when you get down to this, you've got two amendments in front of you here, and one is from Lance Nelson, I guess. That probably is a good amendment that you should say it's not ownership of. It is the rights to harvest those stocks that are on the site. As far as 12,000 pounds, I'll leave it up to you to determine whether you want to set that in policy. It's probably a reasonable amount. I wish we could say that we had more faith in the department to stick by 12,000 pounds or not attach other things to it, like how close it is to another fishery or other things that you could never define. My clients are going to be fine with their farm, but if you want this to grow into an industry and have other people to be able to have farm sites where there's insignificant stocks, you either need to put it in as 12,000 pounds or keep a close eye on what the department is doing. And eventually, I think, you know, we may come to the conclusion you really need to move this to the Department of Agriculture in DNR and take it out of Fish and Game, because it's in with commercial fisheries there, and the natural hostility antagonism of that division to farming, where you're actually crossing the Neolithic threshold from a hunting, fishing, and gathering activity to a farming activity, which took place on land thousands of years ago. It's very difficult to get there. So you can take it as a matter of policy, put in at 12,000 or not, but I would encourage you all to take a look at it, and if we have further problems with it, to take a look at just moving the entire operation to the Agriculture Division of DNR.
Okay. Any questions, Mr. Poos? Senator Crawford? That's a half a question?
How much money are we talking about here? What's 12,000 pounds of geoducks worth?
It'd be worth about $100,000 at first wholesale of the product, of which you have to take out transporting, processing, holding in cold storage, paying a diver to go out and harvest it. So I don't know what the net return would be. For that, they would put it into seed stock bought from the hatchery and sewer. They're about 25 cents a piece. So you go out and plant them, and then you have to wait 5 to 7 years for them to mature. So the question of whether, you know, what happens at that point, can you distinguish them or not? At one point, the department told us, well, you can go and put colored rocks next to the ones that are out there, and then you could go back and look later and see if that was a wild one or a new one. Well, of course, that's patently ridiculous. You're not going to do that. So, you know, I just want you to get some of the history of what we've been through. Really encourage you to pass this legislation. It does resolve the central point of the Superior Court and the Supreme Court cases, which we agree would be helped by having this statutory language, but we would encourage you to also keep your eye on this as it goes through the process.
Okay. Any other questions for Mr. Poos? Representative Ledoux.
I'm just curious about something. Do these things move around?
No, they sit in one spot for their entire life.
Really?
They just once they dig in, they're there their entire life. They just stick their neck up. They filter about 80 gallons of water a day, and they're just pulling the, you know, nutrients out of it, which is why they're settling in a habitat where their substrate, where they can dig in, they're up to 3 feet down. You know, they have to be in an area where natural food is brought by so they can filter it through. That's how they grow.
How do they mate?
Go ahead.
Nope. They're broadcast spawners. The females put the eggs out and the male sheep, whatever else out there, and they mix up in the water and then they float around until they land on a spot that's reasonable habitat for them, and then they dig into the ground. More biology than you want.
Dotto, we're supposed to adjourn this meeting in 5 minutes, and we have some amendments to get
Never
to. If you have a question on, if you have a question on the topic, then
we don't have any commercial fishermen testifying.
Yes, you did. You had the Regional Dive Fishery Association testified, and they are in favor of it also.
Both sides.
So I don't know of anyone who's against this legislation.
Any other questions for Mr. Foos? No? Is there anybody else online wishing to testify? Anybody else in the room wishing to testify? No? Okay, well, public testimony is closed then, and we'll move on. Elkins, did you have the amendment from
like
Nelson?
Yes, I'd like to move amendment number one.
Amendment number one.
Page one, line nine, delete required ownership of. And what this will do, it will allow Fish and Game to do what was intended to do without creating an unlimited ownership of the issue.
Amendment 1 has been moved. Is there any objection to Amendment 1? Hearing none, Amendment 1 carries. Are there any other amendments to be offered? No, hearing none. Mr. Nelson from the Department of Law, did you want to testify or did you want to speak to Amendment 1?
Mr. Chairman?
Yes.
If Amendment 1 is passed, anybody has any questions, I'd be happy to address them, but I know you're in a hurry. There's no real need for me to testify, probably.
Amendment 1 has passed. If there's no other amendments, what's the will of the committee?
Mr. Chairman, I'd like to move House Bill 198 with individual recommendations and zero fiscal note.
As amended.
As amended.
Any objections? Moving 198 with attached fiscal notes as amended. Hearing none, 198 moves from a committee. One other note, we do have a CS for HB 174 that's in your packet. We'll be taking it up on Friday along with the UN resolution, which will be up on Friday also. So with no other business for the committee, we're adjourned.